So we're starting Major Prophets, and I'm kind of exciting because we get to start a new book. We don't do that often in Major Prophets. But yes, George? Yeah, what I covered with Lamentations, I did an introduction. I'd covered the five W's and some overview of, you know, how it's put together. And my thought is, it's a long poem, and you can use the tools for analysis that Dr. Urweiler went over with you and look at it. I don't think I could add anything more. Lamentations, I bundle with Jeremiah. It's, you know, it's his very sad song about the fall of Jerusalem. It's all wrapped up in there. But for now, it's Ezekiel. So we want to start by talking about the five W's. So who wrote the book of Ezekiel? Well, some dude named Ezekiel. So Ezekiel was a priest. Okay, he was, and it says he was the son of Buzi or Buzi, B-U-Z-I. He was among the early captives taken to Babylon by Nebuchadnezzar, not when Jerusalem was destroyed, but at the earlier captivity, generally dated about 597 BC. Likely the same time that Daniel was taken, and we always say his three friends, Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael, better known as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So Ezekiel probably went at the same time as them, but unlike them, he didn't get put in that special training program where they're getting all the education of the Babylonians and they're offered these strange foods that they don't want to eat, and you know the stories about that. Ezekiel is out with the masses. We believe he was probably 25 years old when he was taken away and began prophesying at the age of 30. And if so, we could say an interesting coincidence, or maybe not coincidence, because God works with things on time. Because if you look back in the Pentateuch, and specifically Numbers chapter 4 and verse 3, it mentions that those serving as Levites begin working at 25, or particularly it seems they begin a training program, and then their full service at age 30. So Ezekiel's not serving in the temple, obviously, because he was taken away to Babylon, but it seems that that's when he began his work as a prophet. So I said he's a priest, meaning descended from Aaron, but he's not doing the priestly duties of sacrificing animals and burning incense because he's not at the temple. Okay, some other things we know about Ezekiel. He was married, and apparently happily married. And one of the ways we know, though, that he was married is because there's a record that his wife dies in chapter 24. So he's not happily married after that happens. Yeah, sorry, I don't mean to make light of someone's wife dying. It's a sad thing. Yes, Ariana? How do we know he was 30 here? It says the 30th year, which I'll tie that into the when we get to that W. Another thing we'll mention, there's record of him having a house. People came, you know, it says that the elders came and they were in my house. You can see that in Ezekiel chapter 8, verse 1, and 33, verse 30. And we could mention Ezekiel, the Hebrew, comes from the words that mean God is strength. God is strength, or an alternate translation is may God strengthen. So God and strength are the root words. Some say a different, perhaps, way of putting those words together and translating them would be to say, God will prevail. And all of those, any way you put it, that's a pretty cool name. Makes me think, how did I end up with Frank? I could have been named Ezekiel, which means God is strength. Okay, and the book of Ezekiel doesn't tell us about his end. There's a tradition within the Jewish legend that says that he was killed by a Babylonian prince after Ezekiel reproved him for his idolatry. And that may or may not be true. It's an interesting story if it is. Let's move on to the when. As I said, we don't know tons about Ezekiel. Again, it seems that he began writing or began the record of it when he was about 30 years old, which is circa 593, and that he continued until about 571 BC. So his writing covers the course of about 22 years. And it seems that he dates his record starting with the time of Jehoiakim's captivity, which we believe is at the same time that Ezekiel went into captivity. Yes, Mariah? He began about 593 and went to about 571, or about 22 years. Yes, Justin? Circa is about 571, or beginning about 593, sorry. So circa, because again, with dating, you know, they didn't program their iPhones properly that year. So we've had trouble keeping track of the number of years. I say that a bit facetiously, but you know, you realize you see these records, it's usually dated to the certain year of a king's reign. He dies and then they start counting the next king's reign. Well, I like it a lot better. Like this year is 2018. We're counting all the way back to when they believe was the year Christ was born, which, by the way, almost everybody thinks that's not when he was born. He was born in the year 4 BC, 4 years before he was born. If that's not confusing enough. And the point is, knowing exact dates back then is difficult because they weren't using the same calendar system that we have today. And if you're not confused enough about calendars after Mr. DeCampos's presentation, actually, you shouldn't be confused, but you should understand when he says it's a tangled mess of cords, yeah, things can be tangled. So we have a circa in front of a lot of dates for all that stuff way back then. It gets much easier from the time of the Roman Empire, because the Romans did start using the calendar that we still refer to. So from about the time of the Roman Empire, we were much more confident of dates. We can guess pretty well into the Greeks, and then you get before that in the Persians, and then Babylonian and Assyrian, and it's just, it's not that we have no idea, but we can't be too confident, and there's no reason to be dogmatic about it. Which this is the main thing I was going to talk about today, but it's worth addressing. Okay, so I mentioned he prophesies about 22 years. It seems that he does his dating, not going out on dates, but how he sets dates, from the time he went into captivity, which we think was the same year as Jehoiakim. Remember, Jehoiakim was the son of Jehoiakim. Jehoiakim, with an M, reigned 11 years. Died, his son Jehoiakim reigns only 3 months, and Nebuchadnezzar came and said, I don't want you to be king anymore. I'm taking you away. I'm going to make your uncle Zedekiah king. Well, he takes Jehoiakim away and other people, including probably Ezekiel. So when Ezekiel gives this date, if he dates it from Jehoiakim's captivity, that's the exact same thing as how many years Zedekiah has been reigning. And often that's easier for me to keep track of. Oh, this is how many, the such and such year of Jehoiakim's captivity is the such and such year of Zedekiah's reign. And I know there's only 11 of those years. Hopefully we understand Ezekiel was contemporary with two other prophets who wrote books. Okay, I mentioned Daniel was taken away. Daniel started writing probably a bit later than Ezekiel. And Daniel is there in Babylon. He's in the palace. Jeremiah also overlaps Ezekiel. That makes sense. If Ezekiel starts when Zedekiah is ruling, we know what Jeremiah has been doing. You know, he's been getting thrown in prison and beat up and all that other stuff we covered. Jeremiah started prophesying probably 30 years earlier than Ezekiel did. So Jeremiah started as a young kid, and Jeremiah was on the job for years and years. He'd been being a prophet for maybe 30 years before Ezekiel starts, and Ezekiel ends maybe 6 or 7 years before Jeremiah stops writing. We don't know for certain, so Ezekiel has a shorter career, or at least that we know about. You know, Ezekiel's writing goes so far and he stops. We don't know what he did after that. Jeremiah was on the job a long time. Okay, the first part of the book of Ezekiel occurs before the fall of Jerusalem, and then it continues after that. Similar to Jeremiah, only Ezekiel doesn't describe the fall because he's not there, but he does mention when news arrives that the city has been destroyed. And actually, it's relevant because there's an actual miracle tied to what happens to him when he gets that news. We'll discuss that when we get there later. Having said that, let's move on to where. Ezekiel, I keep saying, is in Babylon, but he's not actually in the city. Okay, it starts off saying in chapter 1, verse 1, I'm among the captives by the river Kebar. Kebar, we don't see on most maps. It's either a small stream or perhaps even a canal that fed into the Euphrates River a little way south of Babylon. So it's in the outskirts. It's like a suburb of Babylon. Matter of fact, some people think that it might have been a canal that went, that connected south of Babylon and then again north, that it arced around and it was there for transportation and such. And Ezekiel, along with others, live in this little village or town called Tel Abib, or some scholars translate the Hebrew as Tel Aviv, which sounds like the name of the city that's in the modern nation of Israel. And we're not sure because of transliterating the other alphabet. This tells us something interesting about the community. We call them captives. We might refer to them being in slavery, but they're not like in prison. They seem to have some autonomy. Like the Jewish captives have their own little villages that they live in, and they're allowed to have their own separate homes, but apparently they're under someone's command and they have to go out and do whatever work is assigned to them. You might imagine even in antebellum America, you know, large plantations might have bunches of slaves and they lived in their slave quarters and their life was their own for the few hours they had when they weren't out working in the fields. This might have been something like that. Maybe not that different from the Israelites when they were in Egypt, although probably somewhat different. So I wanted to mention, you know, so they're captives, but they have some autonomy. And this is in the fairly near vicinity of Babylon. And that's where about all of this is written. Showing us Ezekiel provides us some of the first insight we have into Jewish community away from Judea and the temple. He mentions people coming into his house and him speaking to them. There's some thought that that might reflect the beginnings of what would become the synagogue system. So Jews today don't have a temple they go and worship. They do go to synagogue on the Sabbath, similar to the way we go to Sabbath services. Well, they had to start that at some point, and when they're not available to go to the temple, that seems to indicate, you know, there's some thought that might be when it would happen. Okay, let's talk about why. Why was the book written? Why was Ezekiel called? Well, we have some indication in chapter 3 and verse 17. God tells Ezekiel, "Son of man, I have made you a watchman for the house of Israel." What's a watchman do? Austin?
Keeps watch over the city and warns if there's an enemy coming.
Okay, yeah. He's watching, he warns of danger. Another word might be a sentry or sentinel. Okay, so he's to give a warning. Most of his prophecies, as we just read, are directed to the house of Israel. If we specifically see house of Israel, that name appears about 82 times. Matter of fact, I shouldn't say about. My count is 82 times. I actually got out my concordance once. And significantly, house of Judah, that term only appears 15 times. I'll give you some even more thorough numbers when we get into the chapter and verse. What's interesting, and this is something the church has pointed out for a long time, but I'll describe that after I answer Mariah's question. So, house of Judah 15 times, house of Israel 85. Oh, did I say 85? I meant 82. Okay, but the house of Israel, if we're making a distinction, house of Israel was what? Okay, the 10 tribes, what we call the northern kingdom. House of Judah, southern kingdom. The split happened after Solomon died when Jeroboam said, house of David, see to yourself, you know, and he separates, they form their own religion, he sets up the golden calves they worship. So they're separate. And the house of Israel was conquered by the Assyrians and taken into captivity about 130 years before most of this was written. And they went away and they never came back. That has led many scholars studying Ezekiel and seeing a prophecy directed to the house of Israel saying, well, Ezekiel never does go to there. He can't. He's a captive. He has to stay where he's at. So he writes this message to the house of Israel. And there's a good reason to believe a lot of it is for the Israel of our era, the end time. So it's the descendants of Israel. And that's why in the church we've looked at the prophecies in Ezekiel very carefully, thinking a lot of this seems to be for the time of the end, shortly before Christ's return. And of course, some would be dual prophecy for an earlier fulfillment and then a later. And that's not necessarily all of it. We'll point out sometimes it seems to be more immediate, but I'd say we'll see significantly more end time prophecy that we're sure is end time in Ezekiel than we did in Jeremiah. So in Jeremiah, I didn't say, oh, this is going to happen and this is, We'll see it in Ezekiel quite a bit. Let me mention there are some parallels between Ezekiel and the book of Revelation. Not huge ones, but I've got four things that appear in both books. And you know, Revelation is pretty much end time prophecy. One that we'll address pretty early on is cherubim. Or we could make it plural, cherubs. What is a cherub? Is it a chubby baby with wings? No, I think we'll see pretty quickly. Yeah, it's a type of angel. Ezekiel chapter 1, 3, and 10, those chapters all describe cherubim, and we believe so does Revelation chapter 4. And we get more description of what they look like there than anywhere else. Notably, in Revelation 4, they're described as four living creatures that seem to be the same as cherubim. It doesn't call them cherubim in Revelation. Okay, we see a reference in end time prophecy to some nations known as Gog and Magog. Gog and Magog, which is fun to say. Ezekiel chapter 38 will describe that. So will Revelation chapter 20. And there's some parallel there. In Ezekiel chapters 40 through 48, there's an extensive description of parts of the New Jerusalem. New Jerusalem, and specifically a temple. And then in Revelation chapter 21, there's a mention of a New Jerusalem. Also within that section, in Ezekiel chapter 47, there's a description of a river called the River of Life. That was Ezekiel 47. It's also described in Revelation chapter 22. So this fits with the idea that a lot of Ezekiel's prophecies are ones we might be interested in because they're yet future, maybe for fulfillment in our lifetimes, depending on when Christ comes back. And I'm not setting any dates for that. Okay, contrast. Remember, if Ezekiel and Jeremiah are working at the same time, Jeremiah is in Jerusalem, giving God's message to the Jews who are in Jerusalem and Judah, while Ezekiel is in Babylon, giving God's message to the people who have already gone into captivity. So they're working in parallel, but not necessarily overlapping.
You said Ezekiel spoke to what type of people?
The Jews who were in captivity in Babylon. At the same time, Jeremiah is talking to those who haven't gone into captivity yet. So we see them working at the same time, but addressing different people and having some different purposes. Last thing I'll say on that before we move into what, although what is going to overlap with what we just covered, but Ezekiel is considered a post-exilic prophet. Okay, you know what a prophet is. You know what exile means? You go into exile, you're sent away from your home. You know, you can't come back. So exile is a noun. If we turn it into an adjective, it's exilic. So when Nebuchadnezzar conquered Judah, he took the people away. They're going into exile. It begins the exilic period. So post-exilic is after the conquest of Jerusalem when the Jews are taken away. That's why we can call Ezekiel a post-exilic prophet. Actually, only the latter half of his book is post-exilic because he bridges the difference. Daniel is post-exilic. They've gone into exile. He's away from home. Okay, so we've got those two. And then three of the minor prophets are also called post-exilic prophets. And those three are the last three in the minor prophets, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. Memorizing this list isn't the most important, but I want you to have the concept of this time period called post-exilic, because it's a major dividing point in the history of the nation. So we have, you know, Ezekiel is post-exilic. You know, Jeremiah, you could say, well, he, you know, sort of gets into that, but almost all of his career is before the conquest. So usually he's not categorized that way. I'll mention there are some other books that are post-exilic. That's Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. They all happen after the exile. So there's that break in Israel and Judah's history, you know, and of course, after that, you get into what's called the New Testament era. We often call it that, but that doesn't pertain to this class. Okay, what? Last W, what? We've already covered most of this. What Ezekiel is largely end time or dual prophecy. Okay, he's got these messages. It's largely, you know, dual prophecy and or strictly end time. His language is less poetic than Isaiah's or parts of Jeremiah's. So being less poetic, some of it's more clear and easy to understand. So the language itself is easy to understand, but God has Ezekiel do more weird things than almost anyone else. And, you know, he has him act things out. A word that some scholars use is pantomime. Do you guys know what a pantomime is? Or do you know what a mime is? Well, pantomime means you act something out. So God will tell Ezekiel, "Ezekiel, I want you to go do this." And then you can explain to the people that it symbolizes this thing that's going to happen. You know, remember Jeremiah did that. He had to wear the yoke around his neck. And what else did Jeremiah have to do? That was the big one that was kind of weird. Oh, yeah, he had to take his underwear and go bury it by the river and then go dig it up. So Jeremiah did some things. Ezekiel does quite a bit. And that's part of what makes the book fun to cover. Let me mention some themes in the book of Ezekiel. By a theme, we mean something that comes up over and over again. Okay? So these, I've got six of them. Some are more recurring than others, but sometimes having a list is an easy way to learn things. Number one theme, God is sovereign. What does sovereign mean? It means he rules. God is in charge, and people will learn that. So God is sovereign, and people will learn that. This is based on a particular phrase that appears 65 times in the book of Ezekiel. So if something appears 65 different times, you could say that's a recurring theme. What is that phrase? The phrase is, "Then they will know that I am the Lord." So God will say, such and such will happen, then they'll know that I'm the Lord. Meaning, I'm in charge and people are finally going to get that in their thick skulls. Only God never says thick skulls. Okay, that was the first theme. Second theme sort of refers to one of the things I said is strange visions. Ezekiel sees some pretty weird things. And often, as he's seeing them, he uses this phrase, "The hand of the Lord was upon me." So often when he's having a vision, he'll say, "The hand of the Lord was upon me, and I saw such and such," or "I was transported in vision." He'll describe going to Jerusalem and seeing stuff going on in the temple, but he makes it clear that he's seeing a vision. He never really leaves where he is. Okay, number three. Another thing, this fits with that, is various allegories, parables, and metaphors. Allegories, parables, and metaphors. You can mix those up however you want. What one person calls a parable, another person might call an allegory, or it's kind of like, what is it, lions and tigers and bears. Oh my. Okay, I think I saw one or two people smile. Haven't you guys seen The Wizard of Oz? If you haven't, you should. It's a classic. My wife has never seen it. She said when she was little, the flying monkey scared her, and so she never watched it. Yeah, and I was like, you got to be kidding me. Okay, so let's get back to, that was three, various allegories, parables, and metaphors. Number four, this recurs less often, but mentions of the priestly functions and or the temple. So mentions about priests and the temple, which might reflect Ezekiel's perspective being a descendant of Aaron the priest. You know, he was supposed to be a priest, so God shows him the temple and mentions the priest doing things. Okay, again, we're getting to things that occur less often. Number five is Ezekiel's message, which is really God's message through Ezekiel, that the people of Judah need to return to God before they can return to Jerusalem. So it's a nice play on words, but you got to straighten up your act if you want to go back to your homeland. So return to God before you can return to Jerusalem. One more. I keep coming up with lists of six. It seems like I'd be more complete if I had seven. Number six is individual responsibility. And I've got an "and" to go with that. Individual responsibility and the ability to repent. And I don't think we should separate those. I could separate one into seven, but the idea is the individual is responsible for his own sins, but the individual can repent. We see that especially in chapter 18 and in chapter 33. And it comes up in other places. And one particular phrase is that the son will not be put to death for the sins of the father won't be put to death for the sins of the son, but the soul that sins, that soul shall die. So that's, you know, Ezekiel 18:4 is that classic, the soul that sins shall die. It's not really a statement about whether or not we have an immortal soul. It's saying the person that does the sin is the one that pays the price. You know, you do the crime, you do the time, a modern way of saying that. But God always adds to it that you can repent. yeah, you might have sinned and earned the death penalty, but if you'll turn, put away your sin, you can live. That's a recurring theme. And by the way, the scripture never describes these as such. It's something I've derived from other scholars who have studied and said, yeah, I see these. So please don't take this as something you have to know. It's just to help you analyze and look at the book. Okay, let's look at chapter 1. And actually, verses 1 through 3 largely cover the five W's, which is true with a lot of books. Came to pass in the 30th year, the fourth day of the fifth month, I was among the captives by the river Kebar. So here it is. And this is one case, we don't think it's the 30th year since he went into captivity. You know, there are other references. So we believe he's mentioning it's his 30th year. That's the interpretation most scholars put on it. So there he is by the river Kebar, which is this like suburb of Babylon. It's the fifth year of King Jehoiakim's captivity. Okay, this fits. Remember, okay, so fifth year of Jehoiakim's captivity, which we think is the fifth year of Ezekiel's captivity. So he's been there in the outskirts of Babylon for 5 years, and now he sees visions of God, as the end of verse 1 says. So this doesn't mean he's actually seeing God like God is right there, but he's having a vision, which could be important for, you know, the fact that he's not wiped out or fried or anything like that. Verse 3, the word of the Eternal came expressly to Ezekiel the priest, son of Buzi, by the land of the Chaldeans, the river Kebar. The hand of the Lord was upon me there. So God was dealing directly with Ezekiel. And we'll see he'll do that. God will sometimes strengthen him, you know, tell him he's got to witness these things. There's also an indication sometimes that that means restraining Ezekiel, not letting him do other stuff, but what God wants him to do. That doesn't come out here in particular. But what does he see? Well, verse 4, I looked and behold, a whirlwind was coming out of the north, a great cloud with raging fire engulfing itself. Brightness was all around of it, radiating out of the mist like the color amber out of the midst of the fire. Whirlwind, I believe some translations say windstorm. So there's cloud and fire. I couldn't help but think of when the Israelites left Egypt and God led them with a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. Now, this doesn't say it's a pillar, but cloud and fire are things we see associated with God's appearance. And I can't read this without a vision coming to mind of a movie I saw, and it's been around a long time, but if you've seen the movie Independence Day, you know, where the alien ship is hid by this cloud with fire, and before it emerges, it looks like it's engulfing itself. To me, that's the best imagination, if you've seen it, of maybe what Ezekiel saw, but maybe not. He sees, it says, coming from the north. Not sure if that signifies something. Some people say that refers to the direction where God's throne is, but I'm not certain if that relates to there. Verse 5, also from within it came the likeness of four living creatures. Okay, four living creatures. It's in Ezekiel chapter 10 where the name cherubim is used. So he doesn't say here, but later on they're described and called cherubs. Remember, the IM at the end is the same as an S in English. That signifies plural. So one cherub, two or more cherubim. And he goes on to describe them, and they look weird. They have the likeness of a man. Well, that's not so weird. And by the way, that word for likeness is demuth, which might sound familiar. Same as back in Genesis 1, where God said, let us form man in our image and after our likeness. Same likeness. So what is the likeness of a man? Given the other stuff he's going to describe, it seems it means there's a torso. There's a body that's not the likeness of a dog or a cow that's like horizontal. It's upright. So there's a torso, general shape, standing on two legs. But each one has four faces and each had four wings. Well, that's not like a man. Their legs were straight, and the soles of their feet were like the soles of calves' feet. So they have straight legs and hooves. Okay, so the four faces. There's a human face, face of an eagle, the face of a lion, and the face of an ox. And it gives the indication that each face is facing a different direction. So they're not all facing you. It's like if I turn this way, this face is out. There's a face there. Yeah, that's creepy. And it mentions later that they don't turn, they go in whatever direction because they got a face facing whatever direction they want to go. That also seems bizarre to me, but that's what he sees. Yeah, in Ezekiel 10, it'll list again the faces, but it'll say the face of a man, the face of an eagle, the face of a lion, and the face of a cherub. So where one says ox or cow, the other says cherub, which leads some people to say, does it have a primary face? Is its main face that looks like an ox? And that's what a cherub's face looks like? I'm posing it as a question because I can't answer it absolutely, but that's the conclusion I'd be drawn towards. Now, in Revelation, actually, I'm going to turn to Revelation 4. We might as well take our time and look at it. Revelation 4, beginning in verse 6, John sees some similar creatures. He's seeing in Revelation chapter 4 is a vision of God's throne, and we sometimes use the term throne room. At the end of verse 6, it says, around the throne were four living creatures, full of eyes front and back. We'll get to the eyes with Ezekiel later. First creature was like a lion, the second like a calf, the third had a face like a man, the fourth like a flying eagle. And the four living creatures, each having six wings, were full of eyes within and without. And they say, holy, holy. So we've got some similarities. Now, John doesn't say he saw each of them have four faces, but maybe it's possible John didn't see him turn. Maybe he only saw one face presented towards him. That might be making a big assumption. John also sees creatures with six wings. It seems that we saw Ezekiel saying he saw a creature with four wings. And so possibly these are entirely different creatures. God can make as many different types of angelic beings as he wants. But we see some similarities. And one source that's analyzing the Hebrew said there in Ezekiel 1 verse 6, the English isn't as clear as it could be. It says each one had four faces and wings. The Hebrew actually says four faces and plural wings, not necessarily specifying that it's four. It could be interpreted as four wings, but it could just be that there's more than one wing, which could match the six wings in Revelation. Having said that, does it matter? No, not necessarily. It does show us God has quite an imagination. But I would imagine, because I'm looking saying, boy, these things look bizarre. This is creepy. But maybe angels come and look in here and they look at us and go, man, those guys look bizarre. How creepy they are. They don't have any wings. They've only got two eyes. We don't know, but Ezekiel sees this. Let's move on to verse 7. Their legs were straight, soles of their feet like soles of calves. They sparkled like the color of burnished bronze. The hands of a man were under their wings. So they have human hands under their wings. The wings touch one another and the creatures didn't turn. They each went forward. Okay, so we're going to see they're associated with what looks like a platform with a throne on it. So they have wings spread out that don't touch. And when they move, they don't have to change direction. And we see that verse 11, their faces are stretched up, wings touch one. Two wings, each one touch the other, two cover their bodies. Because they're modest and apparently they're not wearing any clothes. Or he can't see their clothes because the wings are covering them up. I drop down to verse 14. The living creatures ran back and forth in appearance like a flash of lightning. Apparently they can move pretty quick and they're bright. Verse 15, the creatures, behold, a wheel was on the earth beside each living creature. And we see it's the appearance, as it says in verse 16, like a wheel within a wheel. People wonder what that is. It could just be simply concentric, here's a wheel and here's a wheel. But more often we think in three dimensions that maybe it's spherical. And if you've ever seen a gyroscope where there's something turning, that's an image that comes to mind, although the Hebrew, maybe it's just his words were inadequate to try to describe it. But it's doing that. There's a color of beryl. That's in verse 16. Again, we're not certain. Apparently, beryl is a type of stone that can assume different colors. A green is fairly common, but so is also red or a golden color. And that matches what the red or golden matches more with what he's already said. He goes on, 17, when they moved, they went towards one direction. They didn't turn. Their rims were so high, they were awesome. And the rims were full of eyes. I don't know what to say about that. It's just we see these things. Matter of fact, I will mention one theory I've heard people say referencing a Revelation 4 where there's six wings. Because this comes up, some people say maybe in Revelation they were stationary. You can see six wings. Some scholars have said maybe here these wheels were actually wings in motion. that they're moving so fast there's a blur, which might sound ridiculous, except if you've ever seen a hummingbird fly, you see this little thing and what looks almost like a blur next to it that could be like a spherical shape. You know, I don't know if that holds any water or not. I mean, and it doesn't explain the eyes and the rims. Now, to be honest, it's funny, I'm torn because we see more of what these cherubim look like here than any other place, and it makes us wonder what they really look like more than anywhere else. I like it better when angels just look like a man, which happens more often in the Bible. They describe a man. So there's the different types of angels that can look different. I know verse 20, it mentions, wherever the Spirit wanted to go, they went, because where the Spirit went, they went. The word there for Spirit is the Hebrew ruach. Ruach, R-U-A-C-H, which does mean spirit, but it also means breath or wind. You know, the same Hebrew word could mean either one, and he already talked about a windstorm or a whirlwind, so it's not certain that this is talking about a spirit, but not certain that it's not. Verse 22, the likeness of a firmament above the heads of the living creatures was the color of an awesome crystal. This firmament seems to mean, it can mean an expanse, but probably some type of platform that fits with the context of what they're describing. So these creatures are there with perhaps wheels. There's like a platform over them. It's, what does it say? It's there, and on top of it is verse 26. Above the firmament was the likeness of a throne in appearance like a sapphire stone. So it's like this crystal stone. And on the likeness of the throne was the likeness of the appearance of a man above it. Okay, we believe that this likeness of a man is probably referring to the Word, the one who became Jesus Christ. And we could see some parallels with a description of Christ in Revelation. From the appearance of his waist upward, I saw the color of amber and the appearance of fire all around it. Revelation 1, verses 13 to 16, Revelation 1, 13 to 16 describes Christ with eyes like fire, feet like brass, and his face shining like the sun. So maybe there's a similarity, or I see some similarity, but not an exact. Verse 28, like the appearance of a rainbow in a cloud on a rainy day, so the appearance of the brightness was around it. And Revelation 4, verse 3, describing God's throne, it describes a rainbow around it. So again, maybe there's some indication that Ezekiel is seeing what looks like, or is he seeing something similar to what John sees in Revelation 4, with both seem to be angels and the throne of God. Now, in John's vision, he's going to heaven. Here, Ezekiel's sitting by the river. I've heard some people say, is Ezekiel seeing God's portable throne, if God has a portable throne? I've heard that, and then, you know, most of my life, and then I thought, you know, does it have to be a portable throne, or could it just be the throne? Because if you're God, what's not portable? You know, couldn't he just move the whole thing? He's got the power of God. And the answer to that is, I don't know. But Ezekiel sees something, and it's going to be very clear that God is communicating. He's seeing things other people don't, and he struggles to put it in words. And the next chapter, we're going to go into his commission. God's going to say, I've got a job for you.